For Schelling, philosophy begins with two seemingly contradictory certainties. First, he's certain that a world of objects exists, a world that the mind could not have created. Second, our minds certainly have within them ideas, such as space, time, and causality. These ideas are not derived from the world, but yet the world conforms to them. Schelling asks, how could the world conform to our ideas if it's not a product of the mind? Schelling theorizes that a predetermined harmony exists between the objective world and our ideas. Schelling calls these ideas presentations.
How both the objective world accommodates to presentations in us and presentations in us to the objective world is unintelligible unless between the two worlds, the ideal and the real, there exists a predetermined harmony.
How does this harmony come about? Schelling says a single unconscious activity, which he calls the absolute, fits our ideas to the objective world. Experience and knowledge of the world is therefore possible. This unconscious accommodation produces both the free conscious activity of individual selves and the objects in the world.
If we now suppose that the same activity which is consciously productive in free action is productive without consciousness in bringing about the world, then our predetermined harmony is real, and the contradiction resolved.
For Schelling, this mysterious activity, this unconscious accommodation he calls the absolute, creates both the objective world and the ideas of the conscious self. Through this activity, the real becomes the ideal. Schopenhauer rejects Fichte's form of idealism because it contradicts the nature of causality. According to Schopenhauer, the law of causality is the principle of sufficient reason, a principle that governs objects within the world of a perceiving subject. The subject perceives objects acting in accordance with the laws of causality. We see this falling rock strike another rock, causing it to move. Fichte's view that a mind created the world, and that the subject causes the object to exist, breaches the law of causality. According to Schopenhauer,
the idealism of Fichte makes the object the effect of the subject. Since, however, and this cannot be sufficiently stressed, absolutely no relation, according to the principle of sufficient reason, subsists between subject and object, neither of these two assertions could ever be proved.
Schopenhauer casually dismisses Schelling's views as being just a further development of Fichte's work. But Schopenhauer and Schelling do agree on one important point. Schelling says the mysterious unconscious activity that produces the world and the mind is volitional, an act of will. Schelling even says that the will is the highest form of being.
In the final and highest instance, there is no other being than will. Will is primordial being, and all predicates apply to it alone. Groundlessness, eternity, independence of time, self-affirmation.
Schopenhauer and Schelling agree on this. But even though both philosophers use similar language to describe the will, they have significant differences. First, they think differently about how the will relates to the objective world. Schelling says the absolute produces the world and the self. Schopenhauer says the will doesn't produce anything. As we've seen, Schopenhauer believes causality is appropriate only for discussing objects in the world. Second, Schopenhauer believes the will is related to the world of objects, just as reality is related to appearance. The will is the thing in itself which lies behind appearances, but Schelling denies the existence of a thing in itself.
The assumption that things are just what we take them to be, so that we are acquainted with them as they are in themselves, underlies the possibility of experience. For what would experience be without this presupposition of absolute identity between appearance and reality?
Schopenhauer identifies the will with a thing in itself. There's no so-called real object apart from the object that appears to us. The object that appears is the will, But the categories of our knowledge, space, time, and causality, limit our experience of the will. In other words, the will becomes visible to us through the objects and activities of the natural world, all of which exist in space and time. All our individual actions, even our bodies and the processes that keep them alive, are therefore expressions of the will. Schopenhauer says that when we see the will in objects, we are seeing how the will objectifies itself in substance.
The whole series of actions, and consequently, every individual act, and likewise its condition, namely, the whole body itself which performs it, and therefore also the process through which and in which the body exists, are nothing but the phenomenal appearance of the will, its becoming visible, the objectivity of the will.
Schopenhauer graphically describes how, in his view, the will manifests itself as the body.
The parts of the body must correspond completely to the chief demands and desires by which the will manifests itself. They must be the visible expression of these desires. Teeth, gullet, and intestinal canal are objectified hunger. The genitals are objectified sexual impulse. Grasping hands and nimble feet correspond to the more indirect strivings of the will, which they represent.
Immanuel Kant had described the thing in itself in a negative way. It's something that lies outside our experience. But for Schopenhauer, the thing in itself is a positive reality that's visible in all of nature.
But only the will is thing in itself. It is that of which all representation, all object, is the phenomenon, the visibility, the objectivity.
The world as representation reveals the will to us. The will's continual striving can be seen objectified everywhere in nature. But as appearance, this world also conceals the essence of the will. In this respect, Schopenhauer believes that the world is not different from the fabric of our dreams. The world as representation is a dreamlike illusion. According to Schopenhauer, from a philosophical point of view, we can't find any sure way to distinguish between dreaming and waking.
We have dreams. May not the whole of life be a dream? Or more exactly, is there a sure criterion for distinguishing between dream and reality, between phantasms and real objects?
We can't distinguish between dreaming and waking simply by supposing that waking experience is always more vivid. Sometimes it isn't. Sometimes a dream, especially a nightmare, is all too vivid. Schopenhauer says the dream experience is no different from the waking experience. Dreams can be distinguished from reality only because we wake up from a dream.
The only certain criterion for distinguishing dream from reality is, in fact, none other than the wholly empirical one of waking, by which the causal connection between the dreamed events and those of waking life is at any rate positively and palpably broken off.